Lonis, thank you for being here with us today. Lyman County is a pretty interesting place, and what's your interest in history and sort of preserving some of that history?
Well, I suppose we would start with our first governor and only governor from Lyman County, and his contributions to South Dakota. And you know, we are a Great Plains county, mostly wheat and lately in the later years, corn and grass. Of course, the best grass in the country, they say, between the Bad River and White River, between the Cheyenne River and the Bad River, actually. White River, excuse me.
All right, let's talk about Merrill Q. Sharp. Tell me a little bit about him as a person. What do you know about his background?
Well, MQ was a Navy veteran, if I remember right, and he came out of the Navy and decided to go to law school and ended up, he was from Kansas originally, and he ended up setting up a law office in Kennebec, South Dakota. And strangely enough, he was a lawyer's lawyer, and according to the story that I was able to conceive out of him. But he and A.C. Miller, who was an attorney across the street from M.Q. Sharp, both served as governor and lieutenant governor at the same time, and that has never happened anywhere else in South Dakota.
All right. What years are we talking about?
That was 1943 to 1945 that those two were in the two offices together.
Okay, so before he becomes governor, he's South Dakota's attorney general, and he's known for uncovering some corruption. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that was quite a newsworthy article at the time that they discovered this over $1 million missing when you think back to those years.
Yeah.
This was in the 1920s. That's a lot of money, and it'd be probably $10 million today or maybe even more. And they had, I suppose, the best term would be embezzled that money. And then a couple of years later, they mishandled a bunch of funds from the rural credits program. And that happened during the Peter Norbeck and William McMaster administration.
So he's rooting out not only embezzlement from the state banking superintendent, but he's looking into mishandled funds in other governors, and then he becomes governor. And what is he sort of known for? This is during the war years now.
Well, you know, he interestingly enough every state in the union, I believe, come up with a civil defense program and rationing. And I lived through that as a young kid. I was 9 years old when the World War II started, Pearl Harbor Day. Governor Sharp led that during the war, and he started a state veterans program after the war, and also the state police radio network. He founded the state park system, which is amazing. And rebuild or re-energize the teachers' pension fund, and he repealed or helped repeal the state income tax, which at the time I started doing this research, I did not know we had ever had a state income tax, but I'm glad he repealed it.
I didn't know that either. I would have told you we had never had one, but we did indeed, and it's M.Q. Sharp who gets rid of it. Now, I have to ask you, as a 9-year-old, what do you remember about Pearl Harbor Day and about, life during the war years?
You know, Larry Rohrer and I had a conversation about that, and I still played it a couple times over those years. That's been about 10 or 15 years ago now. And what I remember particularly, first of all, Pearl Harbor Day, and it was Sunday, and we had just finished Sunday dinner when the announcement came. And my folks, we had an old battery radio, and I grabbed my dad, and I was the only one of our kids, my brothers and I, that was able to maybe grasp a little bit of that, because I was always interested in history, first of all, but was me worried about my dad going to war.
Yeah.
And after that, I remember the rationing and up picking up every little bit of metal or rubber or cans to, you know, pieces of iron that fell off of the trucks or wagons or whatever, and throw them in boxcars down there, and because they were collecting all that scrap for the war effort. But probably the biggest thing I remember is the blackouts.
Really?
And I told the public broadcasting people that story. I said, Mom and Dad would light a candle for supper in the winter, especially in the wintertime when it would gets dark so early. But anyway, we would, us boys would peek out the window, and my mom would yell, "Don't you open that window, because they can see us." Because everybody pulled their blinds.
And
more or less stayed blackout. And if you can imagine a little community turning off all the street lights and all the outdoor lights, and it was all over the United States was like that.
Wow. Were you frightened of that? Was it more of an adventure for you as a boy?
Yeah. I don't remember being frightened by it. I think my mom, and I think what happened was the war effort, you know, the loose lips, sink ships, and all those slogans were everywhere.
Yeah.
And the blackout thing was a big thing. They would put maybe a slight amount of fear into moms and dads, because they said, well, the Germans could be flying over and bombing anything that they can see. And so, or the Japanese at the time. And so, you know, I don't think I realized the fear of it. I think that may have been something I did not grasp. I don't remember.
Right.
Being, you know, a part of my psyche at the time.
So when we talk about Governor Sharp and these war years, one of the things he does is he refuses to buy a tuxedo for his inauguration because it's not appropriate. He's part of this war effort, you know, coming together in thrift and patriotism, isn't he?
Yes, I think that his contributions were just unbelievable, and then of course. You know, he was the first, probably the first, him and Mr. Robinson, Doan Robinson, were the first people in South Dakota that really thought that the Missouri River was a possible hydroelectric generating possibility.
Hmm.
So, you know, those things, and he did end up serving on the Missouri River Commission that developed the, pushed the Pick Sloan plan, which was the actual legislation that brought us the river dams. And I know today we worry about what it's done environmentally, and sometimes we still have floods, but you know, this unbelievable amount of water we seem to have had over the last 10-15 years has made the dams maybe some people second guess, but it's going to, the water's going to go down the river at one time or another anyway. So
yeah, I think the point of that, you know, that one person could have so much influence from a state veterans department to his work on the Pick Sloan plan, that these years later we're still living, you know, to repeal of the state income tax, that we're really living with the results of his legacy in so many ways, regardless of how you feel about that from a variety of stuff.
Well, like Leo Learning, I called Mr. Learning after he's done the sculpture and tried to talk with him a little bit about Mr. Sharp. And you know, he said he probably had done more for South Dakota than probably any other governor. If you look at the wide and long lasting different subjects that he was a big part of. And, you know, they pictured him as a fisherman with a northern pike in his hand in his statue, and they did that because look how we've already had the dams almost 50 years or over 50 years, and they'll probably say they'll last another 50 before they silt in or whatever generally happens. But you know, having to release all this water like we do, it probably takes a lot of that silt and flushes it on down the river. But nevertheless, my thoughts about Sharp was, and Doan Robinson originally, but this recreation and fishing and stuff will last all of our lifetimes, and probably anybody living today, or nearly everybody living today. And you know, I don't know how any governor could do any more for our state than those kinds of things.
Let's talk a little bit about mining, because Lyman County also has is known for a mining operation. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, indirectly, this may have been a result of Governor Sharp. Also, you know, he happened to own some land along the Missouri River breaks down west of Oklahoma. But I should mention how this happened. Back in the late 20s, the Federal Bureau of Mining and the Federal Geological Survey, in connection with a magnesium company out of Duluth, Minnesota, had done a lot of sampling, and they discovered that there was magnesium on the river bluffs from about 6 miles east of Pier all the way to the Nebraska border. And it's incorporated in this river shale, which you've seen all the river breaks. You know, got that grayish shale that doesn't really produce much grass, or and washes quite alluviously, as they say, alluvial soil when it rains. But anyway, they chose this land. Maybe MQ had a connection that caused them to go there, but also Highway 16. The old superhighway that went through from supposedly from the Chicago to the Yellowstone Park went right by through his land there, and when they looked at the river break hills and access, it was practically all by horseback because there was no roads, and they found out that you know, we all knew that the shale gumbo qualities get very slippery when they're wet, and when they start to dry, they stick to us, and you know, your feet get about two times wider than normal if you walk in it long enough, and wagon wheels and anything else. So they chose his particular land, and there's no record of him having any influence on that. But certainly he would have been working with people that were thinking about this. And it all came about because of the shortage of magnesium during World War II.
Right.
And I don't know whether you have heard of all the different things magnesium is used for, but it's everything, everywhere. It's the eighth most available element of all the chemical elements in the world. And if you count the oceans, it's number three. So, and the uses of magnesium at the time that they wanted to develop this experimental plant down there in Lyman County was for they added it to aluminum alloy and made it stronger and actually made it lighter than everything that was used for the skins of airplanes.
Interesting.
And magnesium is highly flammable. It, in fact, will burn underwater. You can't hardly extinguish it with water. You have to shut it off with oxygen. Shut the oxygen off. But you know, it was used in bombs. It was used in flares. It was used in fireworks. Pyrotechs wouldn't function quite so well without magnesium. And of course, then it's in all our health. At first was the medicine to have for constipation, if you can imagine that. And it had all these qualities that... And you know, as the aluminum usage, magnesium usage had developed, it turns out that most of our beer cans, our aluminum cans for health drinks, beer and... bridges, the steel that you add it to steel that makes it just as strong, just as pliable, and just as you can fabricate it and weld on it with no problems, but it makes it stronger and lighter.
All right, just a little,
you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that's just some of the things that magnesium is used for. I mean, it is used everywhere. It's in our food chain. It's part of all the nuts and cashews and soybeans and chocolate even has it. And even going back to the beer can, even some beers have magnesium.
Interesting.
So, it was during the war, it was there was a shortage. And so that's really why it was an experimental station was set up in Lyman County.
And what remains of that?
Well, there's a few cement foundation parts there, and a fellow by the name of Michael Zimney took some pictures. I have never made an attempt to go down there, and oh, I want to now. Of course, after we got serious about this magnesium story, the South Dakota geological and archaeological people have this story of this mining, and there's about 10 or 15, maybe 20 pictures of the plant and how it looks while they were trying to mine this stuff there at Chamberlain, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And so we have that record of it. And then, of course, when they decided to do it, this, and I remember this was all experimental, and the people, as they did it, they were, you know, naturally very intelligent and knew what they were doing, and they not only had maps of the area itself, but then when they started digging pits and surface mining, and then they also trenched 3 to 4 feet deep and 3 feet wide, which was about the size of their digging capacity at that time. Hmm. And they mapped all those maps, and they're still available. You can see where it was, and then lay it across the a map of today if you wanted to, and exactly where it went. There were several buildings. There were water tanks. They dug an artesian well there. That artesian well, when I was young and in high school and stuff, it was still flowing, but it does not flow now.
Yeah. So much here about Lyman County, and folks can find more online at sdpb.org/images-of-the-past. We'll put some pictures up there. We'll link to SDPB's Michael Zimney's story. You can see some of the structures that remain of the mining. They're on private property. He had permission to go and take a look at those and photograph them. We'll put those links up online as well. Lonis Wendt, thank you so much. It's been delightful to get to know you just a little bit. We hope to talk to you again.
Thank you for having me.